Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
Everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Wings for Breakfast, our twice weekly Red Wings podcast here on The Athletic, presented by BetMGM. I am Max Boltman. With me, as always, is Prashant Iyer. The Red Wings coming off the back half of their four game series with the Dallas Stars. They win the first game on the back of a Jacob Vrana four goal game. We'll get to that in a minute. And then the second one, one of the stranger hockey games I have ever watched in my life. The Red Wings get outshot. Is it 51-17? Is that the final total?
I think it was 52-17 was the final.
52-17. At one point, it was as extreme as like 36-3, I think.
It was 36-3 and then 41-6 at the end of the second period.
Unbelievable. The Red Wings were leading, I think, on both of those at both of those points in the game. They do end up giving up a tying goal and then losing in overtime, but they do get the loser point out of it. We'll get to the implications of that in a minute, but what was going through your mind watching that game?
I mean, that was single-handedly just, I mean, it was just brings back flashbacks of just watching a goaltender take over a hockey game. Like, Jonathan Bernier was sensational, going through and kind of just watching him make save after save after save. I mean, he was just peppered nonstop. To give up 41 shots through two periods is absolutely insanity. And not only was it just a high volume of shots, it ended up being, a lot of high quality chances. I mean, in the Jeff Blashill era, I think the Red Wings finished by evolving hockey's count with a grand total of 5.34 expected goals against. That's the sixth highest amount since Jeff Blashill's been coach. And so to watch Jonathan Bernier for two periods basically stonewall the Stars and then really get them all the way through into overtime before he's beaten on that crazy Jamie Benn shot, it's just nothing short of miraculous.
Yeah, it was wild. I mean, I don't know. Different models are different. I think I saw was it Hockey Viz had it at like 5.1-1 as like the projected final?
Yeah, and then it was pretty close with Evolving Hockey. I think they had it as 5.4-1.1. So
absolutely nuts. Jonathan Bernier probably, if he didn't get an IV, he deserved an IV at the very least for the effort that he put in that one. But the Red Wings come out of it with a loser point, which is a nice little segue into our main topic today, because running through my head as that happened was, this is the worst way for a rebuilding team to accidentally pick up a point with seven games left in the season, where there is very much still a jockeying for lottery position to be happening. Now, I often will try to fight that impulse to even think about that while covering a game, because It is never going to be the case that the players are going to think about it. And frankly, I've learned in 3 years on this beat, Lottery positions really all not all that, you know, it doesn't get you all that much in the end. But I thought that was kind of a good place, a good topic to have our main discussion today. How much should that matter? How much, as people are looking down the stretch here, should they be thinking about this? And how much big picture should Red Wings fans be thinking about draft position as this rebuild continues? Going into, I guess, what I would call probably year 4 or 5 next year.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Red Wings making a late season run when they really shouldn't in the best interest of draft position is nothing abnormal for the team. I think, what was it, back in 18-19, they won, I think, 8 of 9 games as they were going down the stretch. And ultimately, their lottery combination ended up being one spot off of where New Jersey ended up. And, you know, New Jersey ended up winning the lottery with Jack Hughes. And then in, 17-18, they win 3 games in a row down the stretch. You know, that you know, alters their lottery path. So it's nothing new for the Wings here. But I think it is really, really important with the way Columbus has been cratering, with how, you know, much Buffalo has been floundering, although they're picking it back up. The 18-game losing streak certainly does them no favors. And then you've obviously got New Jersey, you've got Anaheim. And, you know, now Detroit's really in striking range of, you know, teams like San Jose, Los Angeles. And so it almost is kind of to a point where this team is potentially going to be heading into the lottery with maybe the 8th best odds, 9th when you slot Seattle in. So you have to wonder if you do that, I guess, how impactful is that on their ability to rebuild when the most likely pick for them at that point is basically 10th?
Yeah, right now the most likely pick is still 7th. And actually, once you get outside of the top 4 or 5, I think that your slot actually does become your most likely because of how unlikely, even if, like, you know, a later team wins it, it's probably not going to be in the back, although that seems to happen every year. The team from the back 3 or 4 seems to go in. Maybe it'll be the Red Wings. But yeah, like, right now their most likely spot would be 7th, then 8th, then 2nd, then 1st, then 9th. And those are the only options. So, you know, you talk about some of these guys that are going to be picked in the 3 through 6 range, which to me is like a pretty good tier of players. And that's pretty much just off the table at that point. If they go back even farther, I think you start to get into really scary territory, because when my first draft board will come out tomorrow of the top 10. It includes the top 10. Honestly, might even be a little short considering where they might be picking now. But when I got to the back of that board, I started being a lot less sure about some of the players that were thrown into that conversation. So that's kind of what got me thinking. I know this is a weird year for scouting. This is probably the year, if there's ever going to be a year where you're going to get a great player in the teens, I would expect this to be that year. But you're still not likely going to get a great player in the teens. You're still not likely going to get an elite player at 8 or 9. And I just wonder, you know, how big of a concern is that to you? I don't know. You know what I'm getting at here.
Yeah, I mean, effectively, like, what's the probability of landing a top-tier player when your draft slot starts to slide kind of outside the top 5 picks? And, you know, there's been a lot of different looks at this over the years. I think, honestly, one of the best looks at this was done by Alan, who a lot of you knew as Loser Points, who used to write for Raw Charge. And so he kind of penned an article back in May of 2020 that looked at this. And one of the things that I think he did really, really well that helps contextualize this is he just took the top 30 draft slots, and based on actual value derived from that slot, he found players that kind of lined up with what the high end of that slot looks like, what the low end of that slot looks like, and what the median end of the slot looks like, and kind of goes from there to show you what type of player you can almost expect to get if you do exactly average at that draft slot. And one of the fascinating things is once you get outside the top 5, when, you know, kind of the most likely players are Ilya Kovalchuk, Jordan Staal, Drew Doughty, Eric Staal, Phil Kessel, like, that's your kind of top 5 if you do just the middle or kind of medium average there. As you move into 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, it's Milan Mihalik, it's Brett Connolly, it's Bo Horvat, it's Brandon Sutter, it's Radek Faksa, Chris Higgins. Those are the kinds of players that you're most likely to land there. Now, there are certainly the guys that overperform, you know, the Sean Couturiers, you know, is listed as the high-end option. Potentially Ryan Pulock is a high-end option, but really you can't count on it. More likely than not, you are going to get a guy that maybe slots in on your third line or slots in maybe on that second or third pair. And while that's still a valuable hockey player for a rebuilding team like Detroit, what's really going to drag them out of this rebuild is landing elite talent. And we've talked about this over and over and over, that right now with the way the NHL is set up, the most cost-effective way to do that is through the draft. But at the same time, the draft lottery almost sabotages you to having very terrible odds to truly bank on it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so I mean, honestly, at this point where the Red Wings are at in the standings, short of benching Bernier and Grice for the rest of the season and calling up, basically like putting like Philip Larson or something in net, bringing him over from Sweden with no practices and throwing him in the net for six games, I don't think you can get even to five at this point. Even if you lose out, are you getting to five? Well, I guess some of them are against Columbus. That helps you if you lose to them.
Yeah, so I think the Columbus games are helpful. I don't think you catch Buffalo.
You can't get New Jersey.
You know, Yeah, and I don't think you're going to get Anaheim or New Jersey.
Seattle's entrenched. So it's just Ottawa and Columbus right. that you could feed. The best you could get to was five.
Yeah, and the saving grace for the Red Wings in all of this draft lottery talk is they have played the most games. Only Columbus has played 50 games. Detroit's at 50. Vancouver is 1 point behind them with 9 games in hand. San Jose is 1 point behind them with 3 games
in hand. But I'm talking
about
points percentage the Kings, here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, presumably everyone's going to finish the season, right? That's where at least we're trending. So at the end of the day, points percentage will end up being just points in that True. Regard, right? If everything's out of 56 games. So I'm saying I think there's a lot of teams that still have a lot of games in hand on Detroit to where if they lose all three to Columbus, I think they do end up with the fifth worst record here.
So here's where I'm going to now take a harsh U-turn, because I say all this, and I do firmly believe that it's in their best interest. Every spot higher they can pick is one advantage gained that they didn't have before. I'm also not necessarily saying that that's a worthwhile thing to do, because I think especially, you know, you get into this year and I guess, you know, if you had your pick between going 0-6 down the stretch and not, you would take going 0-6 down the stretch. Sorry to all any Red Wings who are listening out there. And that is, you know, venom to their to their whole competitive instinct, but from a franchise perspective, it's probably the ideal thing. However, going forward, I don't think that's a mindset that you can carry into the start of a season or in the middle of the season. It really only applies to like right now when the Red Wings are, I don't know if they're technically mathematically eliminated. They will be within the next like 2 days, one way or the other. But effectively mathematically eliminated. That's when I think, you know, whatever you do what you got to do, I guess. I don't think it's a sustainable way to approach this. And especially as you go into this offseason, I think you outlined last week in a really, you know, well thought out deep dive manifesto into what you would do as Steve Yzerman. And there's kind of a couple different scenarios you laid out. One was kind of the very neutral milquetoast, you know, just bide your time. One is kind of the tear it down even further, which is probably the argument that anyone who's pro tank wants, because that, you know, gets you the lowest in the standings for next year's draft, which actually has a couple players in it who are worth tanking for. And then there's the nuclear option, which is really pushing in the chips. This is where you get into your offer sheet talk, your big free agent swing talk. And I think all of that combined with this conversation leads us into a nice little discussion of how patient should the Red Wings be? We know Steve Yzerman wants to build through the draft. We know that, you know, right now that is the source that they've gotten their most promising players from, whether it be Dylan Larkin in the draft, whether it be Lucas Raymond, whether it be Moritz Seider. You just got Jacob Vrana via a trade. But how patient should the Red Wings be? When should they start pushing in, and how content should they be to keep sitting down in the bottom 10, bottom 5 area of the standings?
Yeah, and I think this is the million-dollar question for the Red Wings, is kind of how aggressive do they be in that regard? I think one of the areas, or one maybe one of the aspects that sort of has gotten lost over the years, and maybe it's because the Wings have been kind of a bottom 5 team for the last several years. I mean, I think we're coming up on our fifth consecutive year of a top 10 pick for the Red Wings, that maybe we've sort of seen the fan base embrace that, okay, the way to do this is through the draft. I need to bide my time, get that lottery luck. And then from there, that's when I can really turn things up and be aggressive. And I think that almost misses the boat because, Max, to your point, how long can you really maintain this culture of, well, it'd really be better if we kind of kept losing here before you sort of erase the goodwill that you've got built up over the last 30 years as a Red Wings hockey player? And so where I think that gets lost is a lot of people focus on the all in as being building back up. The all in is go out, sign the free agents, do the offer sheets, add this player, add that player. But I also think that if we're talking about the draft lottery being the best or maybe the most cost-effective way to add or nab elite talent, the other all-in option that a lot of people don't seem to be too keen on is you have to tear it down further to get yourself more chips to play with. Because right now with the way the lottery is set up, even your best odds are set up at 18.8% to win that first overall pick. That means you're offering an 82% chance that you're not going to pick first overall. And while 2022 and 2023 have conceivably three franchise players each, potentially a couple of guys even more than that, still to put yourself in the top three odds, you're going to have to be one of the three worst hockey teams. And so why not give yourself multiple shots at doing that as opposed to just taking the one singular opportunity to do so?
Well, I think what you talked about with the average kind of level of player that you get, even in those top 10 picks, is as good a case as any to not tank. I mean, to understand that, you know, you are less likely at every spot back you get from getting that elite player. But I also think, is the likelihood even enough, even at four, even at five, if you don't get the lottery bounce at number one or number two, which even if you're the worst team in the league, it's only going to be like a 35% chance that you get that. If you don't get that lottery bounce, how much damage are you doing to your franchise by languishing at the bottom? How much damage are you doing to Dylan Larkin, to Philip Zadina, to Jacob Vrana, to Moritz Seider when he gets here next year by being in these non-competitive games? And, you know, we talked a lot on the last episode about the play style. You know, the longer you have players who are bottom of the standings level roster, the longer that's probably the style of play you're going to have to play to be competitive. And I think when I look at Steve Yzerman, I think a lot of people see the pipeline that has been built up in Tampa. They see Braden Point, they see Anthony Cirelli, they see Nikita Kucherov, Andre Palat. These are all players who the Lightning under Yzerman drafted in rounds 2 and 3, who are either very good to star level players. And they say, okay, enough drafts, and that will happen in Detroit too. I look at it and I say, I look at Yzerman's best GM trait as trading. I look at the trades that he made in Tampa, the trades he's already made in Detroit, and say, in contract negotiations as well, and say, these are the things that he does better than anyone else. Yeah, he ran an organization that drafted as well in the middle rounds as anybody in the league. Didn't always extend to the very top of the first round in their time there. And also, as to the point that you made on Twitter today, how much do you trust that that's Yzerman versus that was Al Murray, that was the Tampa scouting staff? I do think that Detroit has some really good scouts in place, but you know that they're different scouting staffs. Like, who do you give the credit to? And I think that was a really good point that you were making today. And I think if you want to take the position that a lot of it does go to Tampa's scouting staff, that doesn't mean you abandon the idea of drafting and acquiring a lot of picks. That's something every franchise should do. But in terms of just waiting, to me, I look at a GM like Steve Yzerman, who seems to win or break even in most of his trades, and say, why wouldn't you want that guy pushing for NHL-ready talent as soon as possible?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's basically two things that I want to drive home based on what you said there, Max. I think number one is, you know, how long can you just sit here, languish, and wait and hope that this tank works? And that's exactly it. I mean, year after year, if you want to set yourself up with the worst odds only to not win the first overall pick because you have an 82% chance that you're not going to win that first overall pick, what kind of psychological impact does that have on those players? How quickly do you then become Buffalo that has not been in the playoffs in I think, what, a decade now? We're getting close to that, and they haven't really been a competitive hockey team in quite some time. I mean, that's a huge psychological issue to just languish and hope that your pick works. year after year. Why not use a guy like Steve Yzerman, who tends to win a lot of these trades, and go out and make some trades to give yourself some extra lottery balls to work with? I'm much more okay tearing it all down for 1 year if I have three shots at the lottery as opposed to one. And so that's kind of the point I was trying to make with this further teardown is, if I just want to sit, bide my time, do nothing year after year after year, and hope that an 18% chance is going to eventually win me a hockey game, then I'm effectively mirroring what Jeff Blashill is doing as a coach of the team, like we talked about in the last episode. He is weathering the storm and just hoping that his team gets enough shots that go that direction that ultimately result in a winning hockey game. And to me, that's just sitting back and waiting and hoping. And right now the deck is very much stacked against you. So I just don't see that happening. And you have a guy like Steve Yzerman who picks his spots well on trades. He seems to win a lot of these trades. I mean, already this Anthony Mantha and Vrana trade, as much as, you know, Mantha got off to a hot start in Washington, I do think the totality of Vrana plus these picks is going to be kind of a deciding factor in the Red Wings being able to win this deal when you look back on it several years from now. Why not leverage that kind of moves and use that so you can get multiple opportunities in the 2022 and 2023 drafts to potentially hit? Now, instead of hoping that you have an 18.5% chance at Shane Wright, maybe you're getting Shane Wright and Brad Lambert because you win both. Or all of a sudden, you're completely changing the face of this franchise if you're willing to do that. But I think just sitting back and waiting for it to happen doesn't make a whole lot of sense year after year after year because of the psychological impact you're going to have.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
So your point is not so much go all in. Your point is either get more aggressive and get some NHL ready players who can get this current core moving in the right direction now, or be bold and be drastic and trade for a bunch of guys in this draft or the next draft, you know, in terms of picks, a bunch of picks in this draft or the next draft, so that you go from there. And that's like the immediate teardown, rather than this bit by bit. Every year you trade off one guy who's about 26 and you keep doing it until, you know, that one big break falls your way. You're saying either start pushing in, start signing guys or trading for guys now who can start getting you better, or start trading them away so you can just have a base and you go from there. And if you're going to bet on the draft, bet on the draft.
That's exactly it. I'm saying either you're going to go out and you're going to get a guy that can be a franchise hockey player, but you got to do it smartly. You can't go out like Buffalo and go trade for Jeff Skinner, go sign Eric Staal, go make a bunch of moves that don't make a lot of sense. You don't want to be Edmonton, go give a huge contract extension to Milan Lucic, trade Taylor Hall for Adam Larson because you're just trying to piece things together. You have to do it smartly. So I offered one smart suggestion if you want to scale up really, really quickly, which is go after Elias Pettersson as a 23-year-old franchise center who's going to be one of the best players in hockey. But at the same time, you also have to go be aggressive in free agency. And I threw out an idea of throwing a lot of money at Dougie Hamilton, who's one of the best defensemen in hockey right now. You go make those two moves, immediately you're in the top half of the league. You're contending for a playoff spot at minimum, and you're going all in on your current prospects as being enough to get you over the hump, because you're not going to have those four first-round picks if you offer Sheet Pettersson. But if you don't want to go that way, then you have to go all in on the lottery, because just tearing down little by little each year and kind of biding out your time for lottery luck, you're going to continue to see aging curves get passed by. You're going to continue to see guys aging into this 25 to 26 range, where now you have to start asking yourself, do I trade him because I'm still not going to be good enough? We've been doing this for 3 years now. Thomas Tatar has dealt. You know, Gustav Nyquist has dealt. Anthony Mantha has dealt. You know, now we're talking about Bertuzzi and Vrana. How many years, year after year after year, are we going to do this bit by bit versus take the big plunge, give yourself multiple opportunities, pick your spots, and if you can get two or three lottery picks over the next couple of years, then you really have a shot at turning this around quickly and maximizing what you have now instead of continuing to wait and wait and wait and push the year out year after year after year until you land, you know, a Connor McDavid type player, which even then, lending one of those sometimes doesn't take you over the hill if you don't have enough complementary pieces like we've seen in Edmonton.
Is how new of a, I guess, stance is this for you? Because, you know, especially in the early days of this podcast, that we talked a lot about patience, don't rush into free agency, all that stuff. How did you get to this point? Or is this kind of a natural progression that has come on because the Red Wings have been doing this for a while now?
I think it's something that's come on over the last few years. I think you're absolutely right. And I should call attention to it that for years I've just said, sit back, wait, let's let the bad contracts go, you know, let the Red Wings kind of, you know, slowly add these pieces through the draft and then at the right moment scale up. But at the same time, if you look at the way the deck is stacked against you with the draft odds, having one lottery ball is nowhere near enough to guarantee that you're landing this elite talent. And as I've done more and more research on the draft, more and more draft work, seeing how quickly the level of talent falls from the first to second to third to fourth pick. And by the time you're sitting in those fifth and sixth picks, frankly speaking, those fifth and sixth picks just don't do enough for you to advance this hockey team forward. You have to go all in my opinion now, really to go after that first, second, and third pick, particularly in drafts that are shaping up to be elite talent heavy, as we're seeing in 22 and 23. I just don't think that this protracted waiting really gets you anywhere helpful, and you sort of have to force your hand and really make your own luck to be able to get things moving in the right direction to maximize the assets you've got. Otherwise, year after year after year, you may be hitting one of every two or three lottery picks, but you never have the opportunity to maximize that talent with that lottery pick. And before you know it, it's time to trade them because they're starting to age out of your timeline. So I think you have to push in either direction, whether it's I'm going to build through the draft and I'm going to do it with, you know, getting multiple lottery picks, or I'm going to do it by picking my spot smartly in free agency and through this offer sheet mechanism, which really isn't utilized, and find a way to add young elite talent that way.
By nature, I am a procrastinator. What would be the harm of waiting one more year to have that? To make that decision?
It's a good question. I mean, if you wait another year, so number one, a lot of the guys up for offer sheet right now are the guys out of the 2018 draft and 2017 drafts that were slid. And there's a great crop of guys. If you're going to think about that offer sheet route, you know, that's really why I was pushing it for this season is, now you're talking about the 2019 and maybe some of the lingerers from the 2018 crop, which admittedly is not as strong of a crop of hockey players as compared to the guys who are going to be eligible for an offer sheet this season. So I think that's kind of number one is you're not going to have the same caliber of players available through that offer sheet mechanism. The second is if you kind of look at it from a free agency standpoint, because sure, you could go out and sign a handful of free agents. Brayden Point's going to be there, and he'll likely require a huge contract. Alexander Barkov's going to be there, likely requires a huge contract. The Red Wings could do it, but the risk is you kind of have to pull both of those guys in at the same time to really be able to elevate this team. The other challenge is by doing this with guys who are in free agency, they're already 26 or 27. Pettersson is 23, and that's the advantage of doing that through the offer sheet is you're getting a younger player through their prime. If you want to go out and land Point, Barkov, they're likely going to give you four or five really good years, but then they're going to slide in the back half of that contract. So that's, it's just a little bit of that timing perspective and sort of making sure you're still getting guys that line up with your core young players.
Why go the route of fully tearing down and trading as opposed to going all in on kind of utilizing cap space to take on bad contracts for picks? Is there a cost that you see to that approach, which still acquires the picks without moving out the, you know, 25, 26, 27-year-old guys?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing you've seen so far over the last year with those kinds of maneuvers is you're not landing first-round picks outside of that Columbus pick that they were able to get in the David Savard deal. And even then, that's the other issue. When you make that deal at the trade deadline, that team knows where that pick's going to be, right? Tampa is making that deal knowing full well that pick is going to be in the bottom five of the first round. And so you want to make this deal when there's that where there's that team that doesn't know where they're going to end up, thinks they're better than they actually are, but has bottom out potential. So that ends up with nice lottery odds. And I laid out that was San Jose, that was Ottawa. You know, those were the teams that those teams were able to capitalize on. And I even offered, you know, four teams. The Flyers have really cratered this year. They don't look like they're in shape to really pull it together. The Predators are another team where this hot streak, you know, may make them think they're actually better than they are, but they don't really have a lot of great pieces, you know, there that make me believe in them sustainably, you know, whether you target a Calgary or another team along those lines. Boston's eventually going to age out with Bergeron and Krejci and Tuukka Rask. You know, they've already lost to Dano Chara. I have no idea how their defense keeps doing it, but at some point they're going to be a team that you can target as well. That's kind of the biggest crux is you saw the Wings took on Mark Stahl and they got a second round pick for $5.7 million. All of a sudden you're going to fill up all your cap space and you're going to be ending up with, you know, darts that you get to throw, but instead of them being good precise darts that are first round, you know, top five picks, if you were able to get them through the lottery, they're now darts where you've been asked to chug a beer, put a blindfold on, spin around and then throw it. And so that's kind of the other challenge there.
I think that's fair. I think people are right now, just my read on the fan base is that people are enamored when they see Shane Wright and Connor Bedard. And they are thinking, okay, get through these next two drafts and then, you know, then it's time to really kick it in. But the potential of a Bedard who is doing absurd things in the WHL, the potential of Wright who hasn't played this year but did absurd things as a 15-year-old in the OHL last year, or even, you know, a Savoie, a Brad Lambert. I happen to like a few of the NCDP guys in next year's draft. I think they look at that and they say, okay, so let's just get through one more year. Let's just get through two more years. And that, you know, allows time for the existing prospects, the existing recent draft picks to show you what they are. Can you get through two more years before having to make that call? I get that. I will also say, while it is possible that Wright and Bedard, based on what they've shown us, could be that kind of Matthews McDavid for this decade, every single year, 2 years out, people are in love with the guy 2 years out. Maybe that wasn't the case this year with Owen Power, but you know, already a year ago, we were talking about Owen Power. 2 years ago, I think it was Atu Ratu, and he fell out of favor. Yep. But you know, every year, there's that guy that you're saying, oh, 2 years out, you got to wait till you see this kid. And then those kids hit challenges. And I don't think it'll happen to Wright or Bedard. But I'm just telling you, in 1 year or in 2 years, there's going to be a name that we're talking about for 2024 or 2025. And it's going to be, yeah, I mean, maybe if the Red Wings could just wait and hold out and get that guy, then it'll be time to go. I think that you can really get yourself into a bad funk of relying on that you know, that one guy at the very top of the draft. You know, it's tough because you look at the last cup winners and they have Sidney Crosby, they have Patrick Kane, they have Anze Kopitar or Drew Doughty. You know, regardless of what people may feel about Drew Doughty right now, that he was a key piece of their cup teams and they got him at second overall. It's really hard to not look at that and say, how on earth do you win a cup without that guy? Even if you want to just go to Petrangelo and the Blues, Ovechkin and the Capitals was a one, but Petrangelo was a four. And they almost did it. You know, Hedman and Stamkos were a one and two, and or actually sorry, St. Louis did do it. You know, Stamkos and Hedman were 1-2 and Tampa won it. They might win it again this year. McKinnon might win it this year. He's a one. I get it. Like, it's really hard to envision your team getting there without that guy. But I also look at Boston and that guy for them is three guys, and none of them were picked in the top 20.
Yeah, I mean, that's a valid, you know, critique there. And I think Boston's kind of a unique way in terms of how they came together. You know, and so they're, to me, I think they're almost the exception to how Correct. Things are going to be able, at least if you're trying to game plan how to do it. I don't know that I would necessarily game plan on how Boston's done, because it is doable, but it's difficult.
It's very rare.
You've got to hit on a lot of those picks that are outside, and we've already talked about that. It is quite rare to be able to do that. You know, and so when you're talking about the rates, the Bedards and things like that, I think, you know, I know everyone's enamored with them. So I guess my kind of push to it is, why not go all in on trying to land them, right? Go all in on saying, let me get two or three shots in the lottery at being able to land one of these guys. Because here's where I'm at right now. We're talking already at the beginning of the show, this Red Wings team currently is likely to pick seventh. Do you think that gets better or worse next season as you add Moritz Seider, as you add potentially Lucas Raymond, as you add Jonathan Berger?
I think it stays. I think they've overperformed.
I think it gets better.
If this season had 24 more games, they would not finish picking seventh. I also think if you put them in a division again with Toronto and Boston, but Boston's going to be on the decline, so I don't know. I think it stays about the same next year, but I agree. Like, as Seider and Raymond get worked in here, they're going to have rookie years like everybody does, and we've seen with Jack Hughes and Capo Caco, the rookie years are really hard. But I agree with you. I think it's not inconceivable that the Red Wings have already made the highest draft pick that they will make in their rebuild.
Yeah, and so that's kind of where, if that's where you're at, then your lottery odds are going to, again, continue to be, you're now banking on your one singular draft pick with a 3.5% chance of being first overall, and that's what you want to go in and bank on if you want to do nothing. And so that's where I'm sort of proposing, again, neither strategy is a popular strategy in the sense that a lot of people talk about them. I mean, I'm throwing out the idea of an offer sheet, and I'm throwing out the idea of completely tearing down this team and trading Jacob Vrana and Tyler Bertuzzi. But the fact of the matter is, I think in the short run, that team is far worse. In the long run, that team gets better faster if you give yourself multiple shots at the lottery in 22 and 23, and you come away with a handful, not just one or two of these guys, but potentially three or four of them in both those years. Now you're really talking about a potential juggernaut team, you know, within the next 5 years.
Yeah, I mean, I just wonder where you draw the line. I mean, like, I don't think that there's a pro. I think, honestly, it's, you know, my move would be to trade one forward this summer. I would take on one contract if I can, even if it is just a second round pick. And then I would start, you know, thinking about what I'm going to do. I mean, with those picks, eventually you're going to have to start trading these picks and not just picking with them. I mean, I look at a team like Arizona that doesn't have a first round pick this year, didn't have a second round pick last year. And I'm thinking, is there anyone I can poach from Arizona if I'm a GM? If you know, they need pick capital, I've got a bunch of them. Can I get anyone off their roster for picks? I mean, I'm going to start thinking that way, but I'm also trading at least one forward, if I'm Steve Yzerman, for another pick, whether it's this year or next year. I'm also starting to look in terms of free agency. A guy that I would look at is Zach Werenski when he's an RFA next year, or in 2 years when he potentially can be a UFA. I mean, I know he's a little older than Pettersson, and that's a key part of your pillar, but I do think at some point you have to use free agency, because there are guys that you can get for just money, especially when you're going to have a lot of young guys who are on ELCs or early career bridges, which Yzerman has signaled through Tampa Bay, through everything except the Mantha deal, which was at the very end of Mantha. There was no option to bridge. That's how he runs things, is through short-term bridge, and then you go long when you're a little bit older. If I was doing how I would operate if I was Steve Yzerman, that's where it would start. You're trading one forward. You're taking on a bad contract. Is it Tyler Johnson? I don't know. That's a ton of years, but he's a guy I would look at. And I think it would be, you know, trying to pick on some of these teams that are going to try to start rebuild and start dealing from your pick capital, to get players. But I would be, if I was going to amend one of those, it would be that last thing, and it would be to wait another year, because I do think there's merit in that. But I also recognize, I don't think you want Dylan Larkin to have to spend two more years losing like this. I don't think you want to have Moritz Seider and Lucas Raymond have any years like last year if you can at all avoid it. So I think they're in a really hard spot. I think this summer is the most consequential 4 months of Iserman's GM tenure so far.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree. I think what he does this summer is going to define the direction this team goes, because he finally has some pieces in Sider and Raymond that are young and moving in that direction. He has an enormous amount of cap flexibility at a time when cap space is a premium, given that we're going to have a flat cap for the next few years. He has boatloads of draft picks, and he has players in Vrana and Bertuzzi that if he decides he wants to keep, he can likely keep them relatively cheap as 25, 26-year-olds to add pieces. Or if he decides that they are trade chips, they're two guys that are both likely to be able to net bigger returns, although Bertuzzi's injury this year definitely dampens that.
But
somewhat.
I do think his pedigree makes up, like if, you know, Vrana didn't score in the playoffs with Washington, and that I think would be a knock against him in those situations. As much as I think Bertuzzi's the guy that the Red Wings should try to keep for that reason of the playoff scoring, I also think, like, every level he's ever played at, he's been an outstanding playoff performer. I don't see anything in his game that tells me that will not continue in the NHL. If I'm a playoff team and I can take one of Detroit's wingers off their hands and I'm going to make my best offer for one of Detroit's wingers, it is Tyler Bertuzzi. I mean, I want to get a medical on him first, but that if I'm a contender, that is who I'm targeting.
Yeah, and that's absolutely fair, and that's where you want to be shopping him to a team that is like, hey, all right. I mean, he's a quintessential Philly player in that regard.
Or like Zach Hyman,
you know, tough,
in Toronto.
Nose.
Like, that's the same role. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Now, you know, that's the thing is Iserman's well positioned to do a lot of different things. But in my opinion, where I'm at now, after kind of thinking about this for several years and having it evolve, is I don't think you can put your foot in both camps. I don't think it can be, I don't think the time to sit back, do little, and kind of just make small moves here or there, I think that time is gone. I think you were waiting for those bad contracts to get out. I think the last of them can be addressed this year with Franz Nielsen potentially being bought out. You know, Danny DeKeyser is only going to have one more year left. You could buy him out as well, or you could just ride out that remaining year, which I think they should do. But either way, you are now in the position where you are no longer waiting out bad contracts. You have a young core with young players coming. Right now is the time where you got to go all in on a strategy. I don't think you can put your foot in both camps and say, well, you know, I'll acquire some good free agents or some draft or some players for draft picks here, but then I'll also take on bad players from another team there. I think it puts you squarely in the middle. And right now, the middle, with the way it's positioned and the draft being the most cost-effective way to rebuild, I just don't see that being enough to bank on one lottery ball right now.
I think you're right, but it scares me to think about.
It should scare you. It should be absolutely terrifying. And sitting back and doing nothing is like, okay, that's fine. But you just end up prolonging your pain. It's like you have this big task that you got to go out and do. You really know you're going to hate it, but you have to do it. But as soon as you've done it, it's done. But until you do it, all the anxiety about that task is making it infinitely worse until you just go do it. And so that's just what I think is going to happen here. If you continue to prolong and enter each draft lottery with the seventh or eighth best odds, because again, I don't see it getting worse from here. And now you're just kind of stuck in this 7-11 range with hoping that 3.5% ball works in your favor. And I don't see it. And now with the changes to where you can only move up a max of 10 spots, if you're now outside of 10, you're not moving up to first. You're moving to second. You're moving to third, depending on where you're at. So it's a dicey situation to just be status quo, in my opinion.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code The Athletic, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
If I asked you, based on how Yzerman has proceeded so far, which option you think that fit better in, what would you choose? Because on one hand, he just went out and traded Anthony Mantha. On the other hand, part of that deal was getting back a 25-year-old player because, from what he said, they do want to stay competitive. So it seems like maybe there is a little bit of having your cake and eating it too going on in that trade. Do you get a sense for which of those three doors his operation kind of fits best with right now?
I mean, I think if I'm kind of prognosticating what Yzerman himself would actually do, it's neither of the two plans I outlined. It's going to probably be close to what you said, Max, where I think he trades one of those forwards, and that's basically the highlight of his summer. I don't know if he gets a first-round pick out of it. I think ideally he would like to. I don't know if it's going to be, you know, one of the four teams that I outlined as high-variance teams that I think could drop off. But I think he maybe trades one forward and adds a couple of small pieces in free agency, potentially a defenseman, because the Wings could certainly use one there. And potentially a depth forward, whether he decides to bring back Luke Glendening or he goes out and gets a guy like, I don't know, Mikhail Grigorenko or another potential UFA center. That's what I think his offseason will look like. I don't think it'll be as aggressive in either direction as what I've suggested. I think it'll be a little bit closer to that.
All right. Anything else on this topic before we go into the mailbag? Because we neglected that last week.
Nope, we should move on.
All right. Let's start here. It's from Gucci. The Red Wings finished next season around 20th in the league. Good or bad? On one hand, your team is progressing. On the other hand, you have very low odds of getting a lottery pick and getting your desperately needed franchise center in Shane Wright, Matthew Savoie, or Brad Lambert. Right on theme.
Yeah, I mean, right on the theme here. I think it's good if you also have another lottery pick, and it's potentially, I mean, I don't want to say bad, assuming that you're getting to 20th on the backs of Mo Sider having a good year, on Lucas Raymond having a good year, on Larkin rebounding. That's some progress. But, I mean, really, the only way you can evaluate that is if you've got multiple lottery picks or not, in my opinion. And if you don't, then I think you're in a bad spot.
I think it's I agree. If you can get Larkin back to being a 60 plus point center and Zadina into the above a half point per game, 20 plus goal pace and Sider having a good year, then I think you can call it a net good, kind of in the mold of what the Rangers had this year. Although the Rangers have Artemi Panarin and some older players who I think can make them a contender as soon as next year. But, you know, they look really good this year, and it's being driven in large part by people who are going to be around a while. I think what you would fear is, you know, situations maybe like what you're seeing in like L.A., where the players who are still driving the bus for them are Anze Kopitar, who's only going to get older and age out, Drew Doughty, who's only going to get older and age out. You do have the Kempes, you do have the Gabe Vilardis in the picture, who are going to be there for a while. But, you know, their best player is Kopitar. He's over 30, right? He's 32, something like that?
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, the Kings have the best prospect pool in the league, bar none, in my
opinion. They do, but I still would be uncomfortable with a 33-year-old as my best player, as a team who's rebuilding.
That's fair. I mean, you can make the same argument about Pittsburgh. They have Sidney Crosby as their best player still, right? And although he is Sidney Crosby, they don't have the same prospect pool that the Kings do.
Big pain is coming for the Penguins. I mean, you want to add Pittsburgh into the list of teams that you're talking about potentially trading with. A fall is coming for Pittsburgh, too, for sure. They're going to go through what the Red Wings went through, although it's Pittsburgh, so they're going to need a first overall pick their first year of the rebuild.
Right, exactly.
So there's that. Okay, moving on. Gucci also asks between Veleno, Raymond, and Berggren, who was on the NHL roster full-time by the end of next season.
I mean, I think Veleno's the easy one, right? I mean, if we're already talking about him potentially landing on the team this year, he's already spent some time in Grand Rapids. I think he's the easy one to start and finish the season, in my opinion.
I think that's right. I think he's the most likely. Next, I would go with Berggren, because Berggren and Raymond, you know, I would say both kind of fit a similar kind of stature profile, but Berggren is a little older. He has more pro experience, although Raymond's actually probably played about the same number of SHL games as Berggren because of Berggren's injury. But Berggren's also produced at a level that Raymond hasn't. So I would put him next most likely, but I actually don't think either of them are likely to start the season. Maybe you're seeing him at the very end of the year.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable.
All right. Eric B. wants to talk about Larkin and how much concern fans should have over his lack of point production. Lots of ice. Hasn't been that 60 to 70 point player that he was for a few years there in you know, age 21, 22, 23. You know, he makes the contention that he's closer to Lars Eller and Blake Coleman, who are third line centers. I do not agree with that. But points wise, that there is something to that. So how concerned would you be with that?
Yeah, I mean, we briefly talked about this on the last episode where, you know, I think some of the point scoring has really been reined in over the last 2 years as Blashill's kind of tightened up the system from a defensive standpoint. So you're not necessarily seeing the same scoring numbers. And again, you know, this is a hockey team that scored 2 goals per game last year and is scoring 2.2 goals per game this year, dead last in the league in both times. So, you know, I'm not necessarily worried as much about the point totals as I am about his on-ice impacts. And I think there's a couple of different ways you can look at it. You know, I was kind of touting the evolving hockey model, which doesn't use how good a player is prior to that season. It's strictly just trying to evaluate what happened that season from an on-ice and perspective. Whereas maybe Micah's model on HockeyViz actually continues to add information to pre-existing information about a player. And so there's actually a huge discrepancy, as you pointed out to me, Max, between the two models, where Micah's model is actually suggesting that Larkin's having the, second best net impact of his career, whereas the evolving hockey model is actually suggesting that Dylan Larkin's having the second worst season of his career. So I think it sort of depends on what lens you want to look through here. But for me, as long as Larkin is having a continued net positive impact relative to his teammates when you assess for competition, that's what I want to see at the end of the day.
I think he needs to score more. I don't think it's sustainable to score at the level that he has this season and continue to call him a number one center, which I've been really adamant about doing. I'm willing to write off last year and this year, partly because of lack of talent, partly because of injuries, all that. I do think it needs to kick back up soon. I mean, like, the guy who I've been comparing him to, right, is Gabriel Landeskog. You know, when the Avalanche went into the dumps, Landeskog's numbers were really bad. I mean, it was not until they kind of emerged that Landeskog came back to being kind of that, you know, nearly a point per game player that he's been in these last couple of seasons. He's at a point per game right now, actually. But, you know, in 16-17, when they had their really bad year, Gabriel Landeskog had 33 points in 72 games. And so, like, that tells you what, and, you know, that was at age, what was he? He was 24. That's exactly Larkin's age right now.
Yep.
So, and the year before that, it was 53 and 75. I think that was about the pace that Larkin was on last year too. Now, the Red Wings aren't going to turn the corner as quick as the Avalanche did, so maybe it's one more year where it's not there yet, but it's got to get moving in the right direction again soon here to still keep treating him like, you know, a first line center. He's the Red Wings' first line center until, you know, they draft someone who's better, which may not be for a couple years. But I do think it's, you know, it's fine right now. You understand the context to the point where it just is what it is, but it you know, eventually the scoring has to come back, I think.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess it's sort of how you want to view it. If you view him as being your number one center, particularly on a team that's going to be, you know, a playoff contending team, then you absolutely need to see that scoring come back. or if you view him as like, hey, you know what? I think his ceiling really is being a really good second line center. Then I think maybe the expectation for the point shouldn't necessarily be there, but continue to make sure that he's got a really strong two-way game.
I think that's fair. And I think the two-way game has continued to get better and better. The defensive game has continued to get better and better.
Yeah. So you don't want to use two-way or 200 foot, right? Because that'll be the trick.
Well, yeah, I'll get dunked on for for days. All right. So, Lars, you know what this one is. If the Red Wings pick like they're positioned to right now at 7th, with the risk of dropping as far down as 9th, why on earth shouldn't a goaler pick be on the radar? Isn't it better to pick the player who is the best at his position in the draft rather than picking the 3rd to 5th D center or wing? You've done your spiel on the show. You've done it in print. Do you want to do 3 to 4 minutes on it right now?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the reason why not is, number one, historically, goalies drafted early on have not panned out in the same manner as forwards, even more so than defensemen. Second, you know, we've seen that teams continue to struggle to identify who the best goalie is in a given draft, and that there continue to be NHL goalies drafted all throughout every round. You know, one guy who stands out, I mean, people can say sometimes, oh, this is just going back to the 2000, 2001, 2002, and 2003 drafts where a lot of goalies were taken and they were all bad. Well, no, I think that second point still persists, as we still see guys like Dustin Wolf go in the 7th round, and he's looking like a heck of a hockey player. Really good draft. You know, Caden Primo, who I think is starting for the Canadiens or is going to get a couple of games in here soon, was a 7th round pick for Montreal relatively recently. So there are still guys that are somehow sliding all the way into the 6th, 7th rounds that are really good goaltenders that they're just being missed. And, you know, third, I think you have to be certain, you know, going to Lars's question, who's the best at his position? Well, sure, I think right now we think Jesper Wallstedt is the best goaltender at this particular time. But I think there are serious concerns and questions about how well we really identify who the best player is at a given position in a draft, when we know that over the years we've been calling the draft a crapshoot, because after you get outside, you know, the top 10, top 15, top 20, there's so many gems that continue to fall through. I mean, we just spent half the episode talking about Tampa and their 2nd, 3rd round draft picks. Those are guys who are sliding that they would probably go in the top 5 if you did those redrafts today. So to me, the level of confidence to say that not only Wallstedt is the best goalie in the draft, but he is by far the best at his position, such that I have to take him there, is another concern. And then finally, we've seen year after year after year, you can get league average goaltending from free agency. The Red Wings did that a couple years ago with Jonathan Bernier. The Carolina Hurricanes continue to do it with, you know, Peter Mrazek, James Reimer. They tried it with Scott Darling. It didn't work. Sometimes it bites you in the butt. Sometimes it doesn't. You know, the Colorado Avalanche have done this with Philip Grubauer and Pavel Francouz. Like, there, you don't have to have the league's best goalie to be a good hockey team to be able to really win a lot of these hockey games. Sure, that's one strategy. And then I think the other thing I'll throw in there to all of that is, even if you draft these best goaltenders, the development timelines for them haven't been the same as forwards and defensemen. For whatever reason, goalies seem to be coming a lot farther behind, whether that's due to just there's only a couple of slots you can really play at in each of these development leagues, and therefore you need to see more time at those development leagues before you want to accelerate them, or it's just simply NHL teams not knowing how to advance a goaltender. I mean, you're going to see a guy like Spencer Knight, who signed his ELC. The Florida Panthers, how many games are they going to get out of that on the ELC when he's at his most cost-effective value? Instead, they're going to have to end up paying him a little bit more money before they can start getting games out of him, because he's already blocked by Sergei Bobrovsky. And this is going to be the case for a lot of ELC goaltenders. They just simply don't get advanced fast enough. You know, it'll be interesting to see what the Predators do with Yaroslav Askarov, given that they've got UC Saros, who looks like a heck of a goaltender, and he's in his 20s. So at the end of the day, I just don't think you extract enough value out of that pick. And when you have to hit on that pick, I just don't like the risk benefit trade-off there.
Yeah, to me, there is exactly one justification for picking Jesper Wallstedt, and it's you think he can be a perennial top, not you, not you think he can be. You think he is a top 10 to 15 in the league perennial goalie, workhorse starter, 50 plus games a year, every single year. If you think he's that, then you can justify it, I would say, probably starting around 9 or 10. If you don't think he's that, I don't think you could take him in the first round. If you think he might be a starter, you can't take him in the first round. If you think he will be a starter, you can't take him in the first round unless you think it's a top half of the league every single year guy. Because you can find starting goalies in free agency for $3 to $4 million a year every single year. And we see it every single year. What you can't find is a true number one, a franchise goalie. And if you are convinced Wahlstedt is that, then I think you could take him in the top 10. I think the Spencer Knight pick right now, which was right around 10 or 11 or 12 or somewhere in there, looks fine on that value because it does look like Spencer Knight can be a top half of the league goalie. Maybe the Askarov one works out the same way. I personally, especially with the way Wahlstedt closed the season, would not take that risk. I would not be convinced that he can be, you know, a perennial top 10 to 15 goalie. I'm guessing Lars feels differently. That's why he's been asking about this. So if what really matters is how the Red Wings feel. If the Red Wings think that they are drafting, you know, Steve Yzerman drafted Andrei Vasilevsky, right, with the 19th pick. It was their second pick of that draft, I believe. And Andrei Vasilevsky is the best goalie in the world. You would make that pick 100 times out of 100. But in hindsight. But if you don't know you're getting a goalie who can be that good, who is going to compete for Vezinas, who can steal you playoff series single-handedly, then I don't see how you can justify the risk that all goalies carry of busting. Even no matter how convinced you are, they carry a risk of busting. So you have to be convinced that if he hits, it's top 10 goalie in the league type, top 15 goalie in the league type perennial player to me in order to justify it. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's fair. And even going back to the Vasilevsky case, we talk about him being the best hockey player, right? Or the best goaltender in the league. The key for Tampa was they were able to extract value on a cheap contract. When they won the cup in 2019-2020, he was on a $3.5 million average annual value. How are they going to win now when he's at $9.5 million? That's the challenge. Right now, you're going to go and commit $9.5 million to Andrei Vasilevsky. They're still a really good hockey team this year, but look at the cap gymnastics they had to go through, you know, with Kucherov being basically on LTIR the entire season, hoping to activate him in the playoffs when the cap doesn't matter. But I mean, it's that kind of mental gymnastics that they're going to have to go through. And really, it worked out for them. They got the Stanley Cup with Vasilevsky. But now here's the challenge of, as you continue to go on over the years with these high dollar goaltenders, are they going to be able to be as cap flexible, as competitive as teams like Carolina and Colorado that have been able to keep goaltending costs down and really load up on the skaters?
No, you're right. I mean, like, full disclosure, Vasilevsky's almost certainly going to be on my heart ballot this year, somewhere on it. I think he's been that good and that much better than the next goalie to warrant that. But I get what you're saying, like in terms of like $9.5 million out of an $81.5 million cap, that's a huge sum to be dedicating to one player, especially one who he plays most days. He does not play every game, and I think that is very relevant.
Yeah, and that's exactly it, right? So he's great this season, and you're hoping that he can sustain that for the lifespan of this contract. But I think that's where the real crux and the real challenge comes in, is we've also seen that goaltenders are just so variable year to year, even the elite ones. That's what made Henrik Lundqvist really stand out so well, was he never really varied over the course of his career. Well, you've seen guys like Sergei Bobrovsky have great seasons and then crater, and then have a bounce back season and then crater. You know, Semyon Varlamov is another guy that's fallen in that realm. There's just so much variance associated with him that you just have to be absolutely certain before you spend that kind of capital on that position.
Yeah. All right. I think that's all we got for today. Anything you want to add before we leave off?
That's all I got.
All right. Red Wings on the road this week, two games, one at Columbus on Tuesday night. That's a big one for all of you who are watching the lottery order. Thursday at Carolina. The Red Wings have a chance to take the season series against Carolina in that game. So Actually, they might have already clinched it, depending on how you want to count overtime games. But very bizarre. And then they're home two games against Tampa. And then they close with two more at Columbus. We won't get to all of those on the next episode of the show. In fact, we're only going to get to one of them. But we will talk to you then on Wednesday night. See ya.